week, NEA New Mexico President Mary Parr Sanchez joined Fred Martino for KRWG News This Week.
There's nothing more important than a well-trained, highly qualified person to be in every New Mexico classroom. We know that it does sometimes come down to the starting salary.
And Mary, we should emphasize this is not hypothetical, right? I mean, I have personally known teachers in Las Cruces who have gone to an El Paso district because of the higher pay there, and I'm sure you have as well.
Yes, I have. And it just feeds on a problem that continues to weaken the foundation of education.
We'll take a deeper dive into some of the labor issues facing educators in our state and beyond. That's coming up next on Voice of the Public, and your questions are welcome at 575-646-2212. We'll get started right after NPR News. 106 at KRWG. Welcome to Voice of the Public on this Friday, April 30th. This is KC Counts, and I am very pleased to be joined this afternoon by NEA New Mexico President Mary Parr Sanchez. Welcome to KRWG. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me, Casey. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I should note that we did discuss over the course of the week that we were going to have the local Las Cruces chapter president, Denise Sheehan, joining us today, too. But she suffered a loss in her family and won't be joining us today. We are also joined by former Workforce Solutions Secretary Bill McCamley. And hi, Bill. How are you?
Good afternoon, Casey. Thank you very much for having me on.
You know, we booked the show before the news, of course, of your departure from the job, and so it did come as a little bit of a shock. But thank you for joining us today to speak on labor issues in New Mexico. It might give you an opportunity to shed some additional insight places where you maybe wouldn't have been able to do so before. What is next for you?
Well, we will see. That's kind of the wonders and loveliness of looking for a new set of jobs. So it's all right.
Well, let's begin with you, Mary. Just last week, you joined Fred Martino on KRWG News This Week to talk about some of the issues surrounding education, certainly beyond just the labor side. But something that we highlighted in our introduction today was that teachers in New Mexico, and especially here in Las Cruces, where El Paso is so nearby, might find better opportunities crossing the state line in terms of what starting salaries are. Talk a little bit about that and what the impacts are for education in New Mexico.
So starting salaries really do impact the labor workforce in education. When, like you mentioned, in Las Cruces and its proximity to El Paso, Texas, and Gadsden, school districts. So we have struggled in the state, in New Mexico, to get a qualified teacher in every classroom. And part of it is the starting teacher pay. So we do, and I think it's widely accepted by legislators and the governor that the salary is too low. And I really believe that people are working quite hard to get that salary, starting salary up.
One note that that was made on the show was that it can be 20% higher across the state line. What is your goal in terms of that starting salary?
20% higher would be great. The goal is that we can be competitive and that we can get a highly qualified, well-trained educator in every classroom. So whatever that's going to take to do that, that is our goal.
And Bill, you can probably speak a little bit to that being an issue that applies across the entire labor force.
Yeah, I mean, let me first off say that when I joined Governor Lujan Grisham's administration back in 2019, we went right into a legislative session. And one of the first things that she made a priority was making sure that the state budget had a fairly large increase for teachers, both people in the classroom now and starting teachers. I think, you know, the governor realizes wholeheartedly and understands, like the rest of us do, that teachers are professionals. And they've basically been, you know, along with healthcare workers and first responders, some of the superheroes during this pandemic. And they deserve to be paid what a professional should be paid. And for too long, and frankly, with some previous administrations, there was this very, very misguided, very, very wrong ideology that teachers somehow don't deserve to be treated like pros. And that is not the case. And it just seems weird that you would say, hey, look, there's someone who's going and taking our most precious resource, our kids, and taking responsibility for them for a third of the hours almost every day, and having that responsibility of imparting wisdom and knowledge on those kids about what they're going to need to succeed in life, and not paying them what they deserve. So I think the governor's administration understands how important this is. I mean, I sure as hell do personally. But on a bigger issue, Casey, it's really interesting. When I was at the department, we basically had four target areas of economic need that we know we're going to need people in the next 10 years or so. One of those was education. There is a teacher shortage right now, and getting people in the classroom is a big deal. And, you know, obviously we'd rather do that through 4-year degrees, but there are the alternative licensing programs out there now that, you know, unfortunately, frankly, a lot of school districts are having to rely upon because people aren't going in to the undergraduate programs. But the other three areas of need are STEM and IT. We need everything from computer programmers, engineers, folks that can work at the laboratories. We need people that can work in the construction trades, carpenters, plumbers, pipe fitters, electricians, and we are going to need healthcare workers. And that's the biggest job gap in the state right now. Nursing is our number one job need, but everything from nursing assistants to brain surgeons are needed. So if people need a job, the encouragement is, hey, look, we're moving into this next phase of the economy. You're going to need more than a high school degree. You may not necessarily need to go get a bachelor's or master's or a doctorate, but you're going to need at least an associate's degree, a commercial driver's license, some kind of certificate. So now is a real opportunity for people, if they want to, let's say you're on unemployment, go back to school, get into one of these high growth, high need job areas, and get yourself a job that's going to provide for you and your family for a long time and help your community grow.
575-646-2212 is the telephone number to call for a question for Mary or Bill today on Voice of the Public, or for your thoughts. We always like to hear what you have to offer on the subject as well. We're talking about labor issues today facing the state of New Mexico and our nation as a whole, and we'd love to have you along. And if you're watching along on Facebook today, you can always feel free to leave a comment or question on Facebook as well. Thank you for listening on your radio or streaming at krwg.org. Want to talk a little bit, Mary, more about that teacher shortage. Can you put that in perspective for us in terms of what that means and what we need to do to fill those gaps?
Sure. Under our previous administration, as Bill just mentioned, we lost quite a few educators because there was a real feeling across the profession that their work wasn't valued, and there were a lot of top-down mandates that educators really didn't believe were good for children, and they felt very demoralized in their work. So many experienced educators left, and then many more weren't encouraged to come into the profession up through the university. So, you know, Dr. Karen Trujillo, who just passed, and may she rest in peace, she did a survey from NMSU that really quantified the number of vacancies, and it was about 900, almost 1,000 vacancies across the state. The state did make some gains. I mean, our Secretary of Education, Dr. Ryan Stewart, has done a phenomenal job in a really, really difficult time to improve that statistic, and I think we have improved it, you know, by about 13 percentage points, but it still remains a significant problem in the state. And there was one thing, Casey, that I wanted to add from the last question that Bill McCanley had spoke about the last time, and that was about the buckets of work and study that we're going to need moving forward, and that, you know, the healthcare and education. And one area that I think really needs to be focused on as well, and since the advent of No Child Left Behind in early 2001 through, 2020 pretty much, led to a decrease in civics education and the social studies. And as a civics teacher, I have to strongly say that I believe what happened in this past election and a lot of the susceptibility of the public and voters to be misled in some pretty obvious ways is due in part to a lack of civics instruction from elementary school on through middle and high school through to college. And, you know, it's by design. People need to learn the rights and the responsibilities of citizens. And I can't tell you how strongly I feel about civics education and folks really understanding what it is to have a democracy. So thank you for letting me add that.
Well, by all means, why did No Child Left Behind lead to that decrease? What happened?
So what happened was there was this freakish attention given to mathematics and language arts, reading and not even so much writing, but reading. And those are two super important subjects. And do not hear me say that minimize the importance of them. But because that was what was being tested, so it was really the rise of the standardized test and the narrowing of the curriculum that elementary teachers who always taught about the first, travelers to the Americas and the history of the United States and the people that they encountered in those meetings. And then the story of America, it just was minimized in this pursuit of language arts study and mathematics. And, the social studies and the sciences in particular, too, are what really engage kids in school. And so we also saw, I am a witness to this, we saw kids disengage more from curriculum that was narrowly focused on mathematics and reading.
575-646-2212, the number to call if you have a question or comment for us on Voice of the Public here at KRWG Public Media. You know, when you mentioned those four areas of need, Bill, one of the things that just kind of popped in my mind was that, yeah, it is our educators that are cultivating that workforce in each of those areas. So foundationally important. Bill, the state is encouraging or about to get onto a campaign to encourage people to get back to work. What are your thoughts in terms of, you know, how we're going to make that transition from where we've been in the last year and moving forward?
I mean, that is going to be one of the questions that are going to need to be answered, not only in New Mexico, but nationwide. So from my perspective, as someone who ran the unemployment office, we had 9,600 people roughly on unemployment the week of March 9th, 2020. 3 months later, end of June, we had about 150,000 people on unemployment. And even when I left a couple of weeks ago, there was still about 100,000 people receiving money. Now, there's a couple issues with that. First, you have people that a lot of them have been on straight up unemployment and getting benefits now for a year. And so they haven't been getting up at 7 a.m. and going to work at 8, work until 5, going home. That rhythm of going to a job, they haven't been in that for a while. So it's going to take some time and change for people to get back in the game. And the Department of Workforce Solutions offers resume writing. They offer interview skills workshops. They offer soft skills workshops. So the time to start looking for a job, if you've been off unemployment, is not to wait until, you know, the middle of August when the benefits are about to run out. It's right now. Now is the time to start looking for work. Or like I said before, it can be a time where you consider start going back to school and say, hey, look, I'm in one of these jobs that, let's be honest, may not be coming back. The economy has changed in normal times, probably about a 5 to 10 year span in last year. And I'll give you an example. The Workforce Solutions Office in Albuquerque has a call center. And up until April of last year, it was very traditional. You come into work, you get in the cubicle, you take unemployment calls, right? Well, at the time that the public health crisis happened, we were not only receiving this gargantuan amount of phone calls, but we had to get everybody home. And so that really was a trick to walk that tightrope. But now that everybody's working from home, look, you can take these kind of calls if you have a good internet line, a quiet bedroom, and we give you some equipment. And so we not only worked a lot better for the workers in a lot of cases, they didn't have to commute in, they didn't have to worry about going to lunch, but we could then hire people from all over the state. There's people from Las Cruces that are actually working in the centralized unemployment office because they can do it from Cruces. They don't have to go into an office in Albuquerque. What does that mean? That means we weren't renting space down in central Albuquerque that we were before, because it's why bother doing that if people are going to stay at home? Saves us money, it's better. Now, that's a small kind of example of how the economy is changing. But what does that mean? If you were a janitor in one of those buildings we were renting space from, if you were a security guard, if you were doing HVAC stuff, that may not be there anymore, right? And that could be true for a whole host of areas around the state. So this is also a time to say, hey, look, I want to go back into the game and I want to find something new. I want to reskill. I want to upskill what I'm doing to get one of these jobs. Now, to Mary's point, and this is a critical point, you do have to walk that tightrope in education with saying, hey, look, you should be looking at some of the economic areas that are going to be open if you want to go back and get a job. So you do want to focus on science, engineering, craft skills, that sort of thing. However, and this was important for me to remember, because our whole job was get people back into work, right? People are not widgets. They are not binary computer programs. And getting some of that other education you'd get, you know, maybe outside of a boot camp and an associate's degree, where you're getting some civics, you're getting English, you're getting some history, it makes you a more well-rounded person and citizen and community member, right? So that is, and I'm out here in Texas right now. I actually had a conversation last night with the commissioner of higher education in Texas. He said, we are going through the exact same kind of issue where how do you balance, yes, these skills in a short time frame where you don't have to go into debt will probably get you a job faster. I want to focus on that. But how do you also not forget that there are these other things that make you a more well-rounded person? And that's going to be a discussion that folks in both the workforce sectors and the education sectors are going to have to really wrangle with going into the future.
Do you think that the benefits are a disincentive for people to get back into the workforce?
I think they could be. I think there are some people that could say, you know, I don't want to go back to work right now if I'm on unemployment. And let's talk exactly what you're talking about. Right now, the average unemployment check on a weekly basis in New Mexico is $300 a week. You can get anywhere between $88 and $461 a week, right? Or $87 and $461 a week. Average about $300. In addition to that, to help people get through this economic time, you're getting a $300 additional benefit per week. So average person probably getting $600 a week. I will say a couple things. Number one, to those folks that are on those salaries, yeah, now is, or the time to get off that is not on August. The time to start now. So start looking for work so you can get back into the game. But I would also say this, people are not dumb. They're going to look and see where they can get the most money. And it's not for any nefarious reasons. They got to take care of themselves and take care of their families. And if a job's not going to pay you $600 a week, and let's be real fair here, that's not a ton of money, right? Why would you do that if you were going to be taking less money? And I think what that really shines a light on in our society is that gap between kind of white collar jobs and the folks in the blue collar or no collar jobs, and really the dichotomy that exists in our society. And I would ask employers to say, hey, look, you know, if you really want these folks back, maybe find ways of getting more money into their pockets, because A, it's the right thing to do. But B, if that is such an issue where $600 a week is a disincentive, that's a bigger issue. Now, I will say New Mexico's done a good job in raising the minimum wage. It's now $10.50 an hour, go to $11.50 next year, $12 the year after that. And I think that's going to really help a lot. But people need to live. There was a study, I think, a couple of years ago before the pandemic, where they said, how many Americans do not have $500 that they can get a hold of in an emergency? And it was like 40%. That's crazy. But that's where we're at. And so this is another thing which is revealing kind of a bigger societal issue, and I think it's something we're going to have to be wrangling with as well.
I want to talk a little bit about what this time has been like for educators, because they didn't, as by and large, have to go on unemployment. They stayed employed and they worked from home. And I think that because so many of our educators were working from home, schools were closed, kids were at home, people didn't really get a sense for what the day was like for a teacher. So, Mary, why don't you paint that picture for us?
Okay, and I am so happy you're giving me this opportunity. So some have described it like being upside down while riding on a rocket ship. And it's because their entire modality that they were used to teaching, and it completely shifted. And in a moment's notice, they had to completely retrain themselves to handle being teaching from home. And that included, for many educators, having to update their internet and their hardware and all of that stuff that all of us went through, really, because since we were going to be working from home, we all needed to have better equipment and more reliable internet. That was doubly true for educators. And I think it's just been a year where it also has shown parents, it's given parents a bird's eye view of classroom instruction. And I think it has been really good and bad in some ways, because, educating kids is hard. It's just hard work. And a lot of people, I think, they feel that educators just have like magic pixie dust that they can sprinkle on kids and they're just perfect angels and they sit in, their seats and answer questions and do read from the book. And they don't, they're kids. It's like, I'm a middle school teacher. So, talk to me about how kids behave when they get together in an environment with, 1,000 other people their own age. And it's crazy. So I think educators have just been turned upside down. And I think some people in the public may have thought that folks weren't working and drawing a paycheck. And there is nothing further from the truth. They worked like incredibly hard. And now that they're back to full in person, it's not full in person because I think just over half of the kids across the state have returned to school. And that's a parent choice. That wasn't on educators. That was parents wanted to keep their kids for their own reasons in the remote setting. But so that means that educators, now that they're in person, may be doing remote teaching in addition to in person. And it's just turned upside down the workday, the workload, which was already off the charts for educators. So there are a lot of pauses that we need to take. And I have the Secretary of Education on speed dial because we want to reopen schools to where they really work for our kids and our families and our staff. And I don't think before the pandemic that was true. So even though the Institute of Public Education, it marches on, I think there are so many things that we need to do better, and including the voices of those folks that I just mentioned, parents, community members, students and staff, in decision making, instead of unilateral top-down decisions. That is what, the shared decision-making is what's going to make our schools stronger and better and more equitable moving into the future.
Do you feel that teachers have been reintroduced to in-person learning in a safe way?
Well, that changes for me on a day-to-day basis. And I would say today, yes. And, I have to just take a minute to give big kudos and thanks to our governor, Michelle Lujan Grisham, who has led the nation in getting people vaccinated. When they first announced that school was going to reopen on April 5th and 6th, I was a little shocked because at that moment, most educators were not vaccinated. And I was very, very, very concerned about that. But very quickly from that moment until today, at the end of April, there's a huge majority of educators. I think every educator that has wanted to be vaccinated is vaccinated. So that was the big concern. But educators also really, really worry about their students. And, you know, the student rate of COVID infection has risen since in-person learning has restarted. And so there is still that concern. And I think until we get kids fully vaccinated, there is going to be that worry. But things have gone pretty well. And I think our state, our leadership in our state has really been above and beyond. And that would include Bill McCamley's work at Workforce Solutions, getting people, because my dad, who's in his 80s, was a school crossing guard and couldn't do his job. And those unemployment checks that he got, I mean, just literally saved him, you know, to be able to buy groceries. Of course, he had his kids and we weren't going to let him starve, but it really did help him that he could get unemployment and not, you know, have to rely on, I don't know what, on his kids.
On you. Yeah. You know, I wanted to touch on unions for a moment and, you know, the voice that NEA is able to provide for educators and how important that must be.
Yeah, you know, New Mexico Public Ed Department set up a violations portal that you could report anonymously, because we have had educators from nutrition service workers to bus drivers to custodians. They never really went home. When schools closed down to in-person instruction, we still had a majority of staff, including administrators, secretaries, who never left the school. And I forgot. Can you repeat your question for me? Because I forgot where I was going with.
Well, the importance of the role of the union, and you're talking about staff, and some of those people don't get, you know, aren't really represented necessarily by the union. So I'm not sure if that's the path that you were headed down.
They are represented. That's what I was going to say. They are definitely represented by our union, the National Education Association, and they did remain at work, but there were some real fears, and people do fear and they're afraid to speak up in the workplace when they see like people not wearing masks. And we're talking like March of 2020, nutrition service people were back in kitchens and schools trying to get meals together, because we know the schoolhouse now serves primary functions in feeding kids and behavioral health and all, you know, and even physical and mental health as well. So there were problems early on, and through their union, we were able to negotiate. Not negotiate, but really just be that voice when, you know, a group of workers are scared and they're afraid they're going to lose their jobs. We can be that voice to let people know that things aren't what many think they might be, and where there needs to be intervention.
Bill, what are your thoughts on unions that represent New Mexicans who aren't represented by unions, and the overall, you know, kind of decrease that we've seen nationwide in the influence that unions have?
Yeah, I'd love to answer that question. I want to talk a little bit, if I could go back though first, to some of the cross section we've got between the education sector and the workforce sector as a whole. And I think one of the things people don't understand when we're trying to get people back to work is that it's not just about, is there a job available? It's not just about, do I have the skills necessary to get those jobs? Those are the two things I think that come to mind directly. Problem is this, what we found during the pandemic is that when schools were shut down, trying to get quality childcare is really, really hard in New Mexico. And so you had a bunch of parents that said, look, if I go back to work, my six-year-old's at home trying to do internet learning. I can't leave her or him by themselves on the computer. That ain't going to work. And what it really illustrated was the fact that there are these additional things that need to happen in society for us to be able to move to get people back to work. I know the Biden administration, I know in his State of the Union the other night, was talking about childcare. Well, it's huge. And people say childcare is an infrastructure. Yeah, well, if you can't get a road to get to your job, that sucks, but you don't have the infrastructure. Guess what? If you don't have childcare available, you're not going to leave your kindergartner or your first or second grader at home by themselves. You're still not going to be able to work. And so all these things are infrastructure in order to create an economy that works better for everyone. Now, on that point, I know Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham feels this way. I do as well, that unions are a positive force in society. The union movement throughout the last 100, 150 years has been one of the biggest tools that workers have in order to address income inequality and get things like the weekend, healthcare benefits, decent salaries, minimum wage increases, those sorts of things. And so we really encourage workers, if they so wish, to get into collective bargaining agreements with their fellow workers and have that ability to negotiate working conditions on at least a somewhat equal footing with their employers. And it's a healthy thing.
You know, I said something we were watching was the efforts, I believe it was Georgia, at an Amazon facility there. And you know, they failed to get the
vote. You're talking about Alabama.
Alabama. Sorry. Thank you. Thank you for that. And you know, their efforts failed. And I wonder, what do you think the factors are that are coming together that are making those efforts unsuccessful?
Yeah, I mean, this is a pretty common type of discussion that's been happening since the late 1800s in America. Mary's nodding because I'm sure she teaches civics and talks to students about the history of this all the time. But, you know, a lot of employers don't want to have to deal with union negotiators. It's easier for them to just set the working conditions and have that be the law of the land rather than be pushed to provide higher pay, to provide more healthcare benefits, to provide better working conditions, all these things that we talk about. And I do think, though, that some workers are just, especially right now, just so damn happy to have a job that they say, hey, look, I'm not going to rock the boat. And I think that's one of the bigger issues. Now, there's some, you can go into and say, hey, are there some things that maybe the unions could have done better in that discussion? Maybe, maybe not. But I think these are not new discussions that are being had around the country. I do think, though, what you've seen over the last, since probably the 60s and 70s, is a real decrease in union membership in the United States as a whole. And not coincidentally, you've seen that widening of the gap where you've got these white collar workers, and you saw this during the pandemic. This is one of the things that really revealed where we're at as a society. Whereas if I'm at a white collar job where I can work from home, I'm making a decent salary, I got money in the stock market. You know what? Over the last year, I did pretty damn good. I wasn't spending money on vacation. I wouldn't have to do a bunch of extra stuff. I got more money in. But if you're one of these service sector workers that put your life on the line to work in a grocery store, work as a janitor, do all these other things where you were a lot more exposed to COVID, you couldn't do it from home, you're still making a lot less of a salary. Maybe you don't have money invested in a stock market that's been doing really well. You're living in a different world. And what unions can really help as a tool for society is to help bridge that gap. And so it's something that I think is healthy and that a lot of other folks are as well. And I think, Casey, you're going to see these types of discussions like the one that happened with Amazon out in Alabama start happening a lot more as things look to cycle in the other direction than they have since the 70s and 80s.
Chose this topic for this day. Tomorrow's May Day, and in many countries around the world, it's their Labor Day. And Bill is laughing. If you're watching on Facebook, you see the smile because yes, it was the brainchild of some socialists. I think it's some communists. But the fascinating history going back to, and maybe one of you, because I was a little bit new to this story, was the Haymarket Affair, right? Late 1800s in Chicago, and workers were demonstrating for an 8-hour workday. And somebody threw a bomb into the crowd, and several people were killed. And four of the organizers of that effort were swiftly arrested and hanged for throwing that bomb into the crowd. And there was literally no evidence to suggest that those people were responsible for that incident. And so, you know, I just love going back and learning about the shocking history of labor in our country. And while we may have come a long way, there are some really frightening things, you know, on the horizon in terms of what American workers might be facing. And this may even have an impact on education, and that's automation, more automation, and how many jobs that we could really stand to lose in the future due to the advancements in artificial intelligence. And I think it was Andrew Yang ran for president on a platform of, hey, we're going to lose about 20 million jobs in the next 10 years due to automation. So we need to start thinking about a living wage. Bill, your thoughts?
Well, I mean, if you want to talk about the history of the labor movement, yeah, it is fraught with a lot of anger, a lot of violence, a lot of struggle. But the result of those efforts are a lot of things we take for granted today. I already talked about it. You know, we take for granted that we have a minimum wage. We argue over it, but what that level should be, but I don't think anyone's saying very few people are saying get rid of the minimum wage as a whole, because we understand the value it plays for society. That was a role that organized labor played. We talk about the weekend, right? We have a situation where weekends are now considered a time for a lot of folks, a time for rest. And that was negotiated, a 40-hour work week, by the organized labor movement. Again, you can go into all the benefits and that have come out of that, and it's a really big deal. And it's meant a lot for a lot of people in the overall course of their everyday lives. And so we shouldn't take that for granted, the struggles that people had to go through there. And I think you're going to see, because a lot of those issues are starting to come up again, as we see this real separation in people's livelihoods, that you're going to start seeing people turn back to a lot of those strategies of organizing. Because let's be real honest, if I'm one worker in a large corporation where there's thousands of people, I don't have a ton of leverage when negotiating all these things with my employer. But if all of us together do it, then hey, that's some leverage. And to be fair, there are a lot of employers out there, Southwest Airlines. What's the large store, the wholesale store, Costco. You know, you do have some employers out there that are leading the charge. I mean, Costco, I think, raised their wages to $15 an hour before anybody else did, without laws having to go up, right? And I do think that matters. And I will say this also, Casey, as you see these efforts take place, other employers are coming along for the ride because they see where things are going. So even Walmart, I think, is raising their wages up to $12 an hour in most places, even if that's above the minimum wage laws in their places, because of the power of organization. So I think that's a really, really big deal that we should not take for granted.
And we were talking about that effort for the 8-hour workday. And Mary, I was thinking about educators, because recently the Las Cruces Public School Board decided not to extend the calendar for the school year. And that was, there were some really impassioned arguments from teachers talking about what they've been through over the course of the last year and how they need that break. And I think when it comes down to it, teachers, when they're in session and schools in session, don't work anywhere close to an 8-hour day.
So there's a couple of things I wanted to talk about. One was to piggyback on what Bill just said, and that is that in areas that have strong labor organizations, labor unions, working conditions and conditions for people are generally better. So you could look at the state of Massachusetts, for example, really strong labor organizations, teachers unions in that state, and the schools in Massachusetts, by and large, the salaries are higher, there's more autonomy in the job, and students perform better in that state. So it isn't just, you know, when labor organizations are in certain sectors of the economy, I mean, everybody in that sector is lifted up, not just the people in the labor organization. And that, That is why I think, too, there's always that tension. There's a healthy tension between management and labor, because the only real power of the workers is that solidarity, you know, and it goes up against big money. And we have seen just the big money split and the lower wages. We have just seen a huge split in those two. And so I really hope to see the rise of labor again, because it is what kept children out of the workplace and from getting killed and people getting black lung. I mean, we are still to this day the force for working people, you know, people that go to work every day to earn a paycheck and to try to have health care and a pension when they retire. And those things have been vilified, and there's really not a villain in there. You know, these are working people that we that are playing by the rules, and they want what they've been promised, the promise that our country has promised folks. So, you know, you bring up the Las Cruces Public Schools and the school board meeting and educators who spoke. So this is a great example of just management not really understanding what labor feels. So educators right now have been in a really difficult year, the most difficult year of their careers. And they have been working, and they've been working all hours of the day and night, you know, doing virtual learning, remote learning, but then also calling and tracking down kids and trying to find out where they are and are they eating and getting packets together to send home. And so it has been a very draining, and we have a lot of poverty in New Mexico. You know, a lot of our kids, and especially in Doñana County, but across the state, 40% are food insecure. So, you know, these children that have real, real needs that are not being met, access to a healthcare provider, it is very draining on the educator who works day in and day out with those students. And so right now the legislature in this past session has put a lot of money into extending the calendar in the school year. And those are great things. And many parents may want that. Some may not. You know, it just depends on the situation. The people who make decisions really believe that we need to extend that calendar. Educators have said since December that they can't do it. They just can't do it. They, you know, so if we're going to extend the calendar and have after school, then we need to bring in the Boys and Girls Club. We need to bring in the city of Las Cruces, Parks and Rec, and we need to be a little bit more creative about how we extend those programs, because educators are, they're not going to be able to work to start a brand new school year like on July 7th, which is what some calendars were proposing. You know, educators also have families, and they have parents that are sick, and they, you know, so it's interesting that you brought up the K-5 plus and extended learning. And it's not that educators oppose those things, because they don't. If it's good for a child, and those programs may be good for kids, educators support them, but they just don't support them this year, right at this moment, because of the workload, because of the, you know, we have survived a pandemic. And we tend to try to minimize that and just move on to the very next thing. It has been a challenging time. Like my colleague, Denise Sheehan, is not here with us today because she lost her grandfather, and she has lost close family members, 5 or 6 people that have died because of COVID. We've lost educators in Las Cruces, especially classroom teachers, beloved classroom teachers, educational assistants, custodians have passed away because of COVID. It has been a year fraught with emotion and with having to relearn your job and your own personal suffering that, you know, at loss, grieving. So, the union has really tried to broker this conversation with legislators and the governor and the secretary to say, it's not that we oppose these programs. It's just educators they can't do, there's not an unlimited amount of things they can do. They have a limit and they have reached it.
Yes.
I hope I answered your question.
Well, you reminded me of the last time Dr. Trujillo was a guest on our show, and that was literally 1 week before she was killed. And we began our conversation to take a moment to recognize those losses that the district has suffered. And not 5 minutes before we made contact, just before going on the air, she had just learned of another educator's passing. And you could hear how that affected her. And yet she was able to speak of so much hope of getting back into in-person learning. And she, too, was surprised by the decision of going that April date of returning, because, you know, those things are kind of announced to everyone all at the same time. So there's been so many adjustments along the way. But, you know, I know that that many educators are still grieving her loss as well. And It's 150, and 575-646-2212 is the number to call. We are quickly running out of time here, but I wanted to try to spend a few minutes on the news that is coming out of the census. We are looking at a decrease in population and for New Mexico, potentially, and there was a very slow growth in the 2020 census. Bill, I want to get your perspective, you know, on kind of what that means and how that's going to affect our labor force in the future and retirees for that matter.
Yeah, I think this is an issue that New Mexico has been dealing with for the last 30 or 40 years, where you get a situation where young people, they get an education, they want to go and get a job somewhere else. They want to go to Dallas, Denver, and Phoenix. And the only way that we're going to be able to reverse that trend is to diversify the economy. You know, we have such a high reliance in New Mexico for economic growth on tourism, oil and gas, the energy sector, and then federal government jobs. You know, in Los Alamos, obviously the labs, a lot of the military bases at Holloman and out in Clovis and places like that, where when those things aren't doing great, we suffer. And we saw that happen with the oil and gas industry back in 2015. We had to cut the state budget because the prices went low. And then, you know, Mary's on here. What happens then? Schools get affected because that's school budgets right there, right? I think the only way we get around that is by doing what some of our neighbor states have done, which is really invest in education and infrastructure for different parts of the economy that you see are going to grow. You know, when I was in grad school studying public policy, we had a really, really interesting case study about the South in the 90s, where you had all these different states that were throwing incentives at all these different car manufacturers and other types of manufacturers all the time. And these companies would say, okay, where can I get the best incentives? Stay for 3 or 4 years and go to the next state over. What North Carolina did, though, was very, very different. And what they said was, we're going to invest in two things that's going to allow our economy to grow. Number one, they have the research triangle. So Raleigh, Durham, around that area where you have these three huge universities, you invested in tech, you invested in a lot of these different jobs that allowed you, if you're North Carolina, to diversify away from their two big industries at the time were tobacco and textiles, which were on the downhill, right? They also, and this is a biggie, invested in early childhood education. Huge investments in pre-K education. And those two things, growing slowly over the course of 15, 20 years, really had an effect to where North Carolina went from down where New Mexico tends to be in a lot of different places, up the list in terms of per capita income, people with jobs, et cetera, and so on. I think New Mexico took a huge step. Well, the people of New Mexico can take a huge step in November by voting yes on the constitutional amendment to tap the permanent fund for early childhood education. That's a huge deal that will provide absolute real long-term gains for the state, not only just for those kids right now, but for the long-term growth of their selves as people. It's going to help a lot. The other thing I think it's going to be important is, how do you say, okay, the film industry, that's a place where we do pretty well. How do we keep that going? When we look at value-added agriculture, you know, we grow a lot of food in New Mexico. We don't produce a lot of it. You know, we don't make a lot of salsa, even though we grow all the chili. We don't do a lot with pecans, even though we grow all the pecans. How do we get more of that production here in New Mexico? And then some of the tech stuff. You know, there's a really nice little IT industry in Albuquerque. I think you're seeing that in Las Cruces with electronic caregiver and some of those other types of industries. How do we grow those other areas out so there is a more diverse, more open, more productive economic situation that's going to allow people to stay in New Mexico and make a decent salary if they want to? I think that's really, really important. And getting away from those things that we have just always run back to and grab hold of and trying to take some risks, the spaceport. You know, I get a lot of crap when I was on the county commission for really pushing Spaceport America. But Virgin Galactic now has 138, 150 employees somewhere in there in New Mexico. A lot of those are New Mexicans that are getting those jobs. How do you make sure stuff like that, you can take those calculated risks? Because if you don't, you're going to be stuck in the same old rut. If you do, you're not going to, you know, hit a home run all the time, but it's absolutely vital for New Mexico to keep growing.
We have Mark on the line who has a question for you, Bill. Hi, Mark. Good afternoon. Thank you for calling and thanks for your patience.
Hi, good afternoon. Well, yeah, my question is concerning the unemployment insurance scenario as it is now. As Bill knows, the state is trying to claw back from thousands of unemployed people the insurance money that was paid out to them legally, and not only the state money, but the federal. They want to get back the federal funds that were also paid out, and plus they've tacked on a 25% penalty to the uninsured people and people who are not guilty of fraud, by the way, of any kind. And I'm just curious how Mr. McCamley sleeps at night.
Bill, where do you want to start?
Well, so overpayments and unemployment are generated for a number of reasons. The most common one that we saw is that people would apply for pandemic unemployment assistance, which was the special program that was put into place for self-employed people. They would apply for that money. There was such a huge rush to get that money out the door because of the need when it came out that a lot we generally put in a thing, say, yeah, we'll give you that money. The problem is this: the federal government requires the state to check for wages. And so I'll give you an example. There was a lady down in Las Cruces where she had received some money through the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program. We later found, because she didn't report it, that she had wages in Texas that were enough that would qualify her for the unemployment program in Texas. When that is found, the federal government, who controls this situation, who provides all the money for these specialized programs, requires us to stop those payments and ask for that money back because that is an overpayment. There are other scenarios as well, but overpayments happen. And most of the time, they are taken care of because people stay on an unemployment program and we can take those wages back in increments as we pay it out. It's been one of the hardest things that the unemployment office has had to deal with. And it's mostly as a result of these kind of different changes in programs. Now, I will say also, overpayments generally happen because of fraud in traditional unemployment, where people say, hey, look, I'm unemployed, and they don't tell us about the jobs that they have. We go back and find that they had wages and that they should not have been getting money. That is illegal. And so that is the traditional cases for unemployment. We have had situations because of all the different chops and changes and starts and stops to programs where these things have been generated. And to people's credit, a lot of times they don't understand the system. It is a complicated system that is not set up for the economy today. And that is what's going on. But trust me, overpayments are not something that I did voluntarily. It's not something anybody likes to do. It's not something people take joy in life because people are hurting and saying, hey, you owe that money back. That's not an easy thing to do. It sucks really, really bad. Yeah, but a lot of these are federal requirements, and unfortunately, that is what the federal government says has to do. And if we don't do it, they take our money away. We don't have unemployment programs at all, and that's kind of unfortunately the situation.
Mm. Now, with the couple of minutes that we have left, Mary, I wanted to get back to that topic that we spent a few minutes with Bill on, and that is the prediction for the population decrease. And your thoughts on what that means for the future of education funding in New Mexico, and what we have to do to prepare for it.
So my thoughts are right away that I feel like the census wasn't rolled out like it could have been. I mean, maybe it wasn't the rollout, and I'm certainly not blaming the census workers. I just think that there were attempts, I believe, to shut the census down sooner than it needed to be. I don't know that we counted everybody that actually is in the state of New Mexico, because New Mexico, as you know, is a border state, and we have people here that are afraid of government people coming to their front door. And I think just because of the pandemic too, the schools could have played a bigger role in making sure that people logged on and completed their census information, but they weren't able to assist in that way because of the pandemic. So I do worry about it. I you know, it will affect jobs for educators. And I don't like to see kids leave the state because they can't find employment. I know my son who works in the oil fields in Odessa, I am trying to get him back to green energy school in Tucumcari so that he can do, you know, use this time to learn a new trade, because we do have to look to the future. And with just a little bit of training, I think we can get our kids back to stay in the state, and we need their talent here. So it's worrisome, but I question if the numbers are accurate and whether we counted everybody.
Well, there were certainly lots of recounts in 2020, and they're continuing in 2021. So it remains to be seen if we might do something about the 2020 census as well. NEA President Mary Parr Sanchez, thank you so much for spending some time with us today on Voice of the Public.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And Bill McCamley, former Workforce Solutions Secretary, thank you. Please stay in touch and let us know where you land.
Thank you, Casey.
It is almost time for intermezzo. Lior Zeitlin is off today. Enjoy classical music, though, over the next couple of hours. And then I'll see you back here for All Things Considered coming up at 4 o'clock. And, of course, tonight at 7, it's Emily Guerra and your Friday Fiesta.